Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power, but more than that, historical power regarding Native Americans. Now, here in America, we have such a rich legacy of so many people that lived here long before the Europeans came into the picture. And my guest today, Robert Vetter, is a man that had the opportunity to tell the story of a Kiowa Indian named Big Bow. And when I went through the book, I was so impressed with the way the information was presented. I think one of the greatest things we can ever leave when we are a part of life is a legacy that empowers the people that come behind us. And that is exactly what I feel that Robert Vetter, who's with me today, and Richard Tarsage Sr., when they put together this book, Big Bow, The Spiritual Life and Teachings of a Kiowa Family, that's what they've done. They've left us a legacy from the past that I think can empower us today. Hello, Robert Vetter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Donna. It's my pleasure to be here.
I really enjoyed your book. And I know that this was a very, very special journey for you. Now, you are an anthropologist and an educational consultant, and your deep interests have been for years the Native American culture, and you created Journeys into American Indian Territory because you wanted people who did not have Native American background to understand the world of the Native American, which often was considered very, well, isolated. It was a very secretive world. It wasn't something that many people wanted to explore. And you have been written up in the New York Times, the Washington Post. You've been on the Travel Channel's Lonely Planet Trek. How did you find yourself following the direction of becoming not just a researcher, but also someone that was able to, you might say, walk the walk with someone like Big Bow?
Well, it wasn't originally my intention, and that's why the story is, I think, an interesting one in that I stumbled upon this road, or maybe it was my destiny. That's the way I'd like to look at it. I grew up in New York and never really had any interaction with Native Americans of any kind other than maybe going to a powwow or two as a boy. But I was I went to college in upstate New York, and I had planned on taking a year off before going to graduate school, and I had a philosophy professor at Oneonta who was connected with a philosophy professor at the University of Oklahoma. And even though I was an anthropology major, he still felt that I had a strong enough background in philosophy and liked the work that I had done. So he basically put it together for me to go from New York to the University of Oklahoma, first in the philosophy department with an assistantship. Well, I hated the philosophy department so much, the courses that I was taking at least, so mm-hmm. much that I was ready to walk out and go back to New York. But on a whim, I walked down a couple of floors in the same building to the anthropology department just to ask them if anything was going on there, if I could somehow get involved in the anthropology department. And as it turned out, somebody who was teaching Introduction to Anthropology had walked out the day before, and they desperately needed somebody to fulfill that. Now,
wow.
as a graduate student, I had to keep a full-time course load in order to receive that assistantship and be able to teach the course and get the financial aid. So since it was too late in the semester for me to enroll in courses, they agreed that they would allow me to do an independent study project in something called ethnography, which is the branch of cultural anthropology where you are immersed in a culture and do interviewing. We call this participant observation. So you are participating in a culture, but also removed from it and observing it. So it was this project that got me started down this road that I knew nothing about. Now, I knew that my area of interest was spirituality and healing, where those two things intersect. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get to know a medicine man. I went to my advisor, I told him what my project was, and I told him that this was my area of interest. He told me, well, that's great. You know, you'll have to go out and you'll have to use a networking approach. Now, I thought he was going to just tell me, well, if you want to meet a medicine man, you know, go meet Mr. Smith. You know, I thought it would be mm-hmm. that simple. But all he told me was, you'll have to go out and find this person on your own. Now, I didn't know a single person in the state, so this was a very difficult project. I went back. It turned out that my roommate was a quarter Comanche. And I didn't realize that, but he told me that he could possibly introduce me to some of the members of his family. Eventually, I met this medicine man through another elder, a Comanche elder named Wudji Wachitaker. So eventually, I met Oliver Pataponi, who was the last medicine man of the Comanches. He adopted me as a grandson, so that was the first adoption that I had in a long series of adoptions that I feel like I have been blessed with. So that was the way that I started down this road. And I like that you referred to it as a road, because that is really what traditional elders call this, that it really is a road that you choose to walk for the remainder of your life. So I feel blessed to have been welcomed into these families, to become a part of these families, and to be asked to be a part of these ceremonies. So that was just the first piece of this very, very long story.
I found it intriguing, and I'll go back to what you said, that here you are in college. You just are totally disgusted and disillusioned with what you're involved with. You just go, this is not what I want. You walk down to an anthropology department. Now, what are the odds of you're walking in and saying, you know what, I want to know what's going on here. You don't even know anything. And you walk in, you say, I wonder, what have you got going on here? You are just totally, totally, completely detached. And that is the unexpected magic step, if you will, as if you've been called into this. And I think that so many times there are those pivotal moments, and that was a very big one for you. Now, what I want to do is jump forward in time, because like you said, there were many different links. And it has been my awareness that in the Native American culture, because of the abuses that went on in the past, and so many of the elders did not have those of their own community that were going to be able to carry things forward, the shaman, et cetera. This is a very difficult time, and it has intrigued me how, with various interviews that I've done through the years, that many times the elders will find someone from outside the tribe that they can leave their story with.
Exactly.
Because they know somewhere there's going to be a link that moves forward. And I find this so fascinating. And that is what has happened to you. You were an outsider, yet you're not an outsider, because they recognize in you, in fact, there was an elder by the name of Richie Tarsa.
Yeah.
And this is so amazing, because you were taken by a Cato Indian elder, Fred Parton, and he adopted you as a son. You used the term fictive kinship. And I'd never heard that word, fictive, F-I-C-T-I-V-E, kinship. But Richie said to you, I knew you were coming because I had a dream, and God told me that someone would come here bringing people from all over the world. Now, this, when somebody's listening to this kind of a story, they may want to roll their eyes and go, oh, yeah, sure, here we go. But this is a part of the cultural training that they had. They listened to what they often called the Great Spirit, to what the messages were that came either from those on the other side, from the Great Spirit, and they had that expectation. They were known for their visions. There were those. And Richie was an elder. Tell us about fictive kinship. You've given us a little bit of an insight.
Yeah, anthropologists use this term, fictive kinship. And let me just say that the Indian elders themselves never use that term. But just to make it understandable, fictive kinship is when some, either an individual or a family extends a kin relationship to somebody who they're not related to by blood. And this is a practice that goes way back into the past. And for tribal peoples, it makes sense because it basically increases the size of your family and your community and your tribe when you let somebody in and they become a family member. It increases your numbers. It increases your strength. You know, everything about people in close-knit community is improved through the extending of these relations. So this is something that has a long history that goes back way before the invasion of Europeans into this continent. So it's fairly common. It's not all that common for non-Indians to be adopted. I mean, it does mm-hmm. happen. I don't mean to say that it doesn't happen, but it's not that common in the sense that there aren't that many people, non-Indians, in Indian country who have a reason to go there in the first place. And unfortunately, in the parts of the United States where there are the greatest population of Native Americans, there tends to also be the greatest prejudice against them. Mm-hmm. So in most parts of Indian country, the average non-Indian from an adjacent community really has no purpose in going in there in the first place. So I'm unusual in the sense that I was an anthropologist, and I wanted to go into these communities and do these studies. But more than even being an anthropologist, it came to be that I was there for my own personal and spiritual reasons. And I think that's the thing that maybe was different about me, because mm-hmm. most anthropologists come in as social scientists, and I'm putting the emphasis on scientists here, and I think sometimes traditional people feel like they're a bug under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the process of studying people, there is a tendency to turn them into objects, and that was something that really upset me from the very beginning. And I would see other anthropologists go into the field, learn what they needed to know, sometimes write a book about it, and then disappear. So mm-hmm. I had elders ask me, oh, whatever happened to such and such? I'm not going to mention any names, but whatever happened to this particular person? You know, we got to be friends with him, and then he disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have felt like is I went in, I was lucky enough to be taken in by these families, but I think it carries along with it a lifelong obligation. So I am connected to these families for the remainder of my life,
mm-hmm.
and it carries with it the same responsibilities that I have to my biological family.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I think makes your book very exceptional, too, because you were able to relate a lot of information regarding Richie's family. And one of the things that he said is that he knew that he was going to be eventually passing away. We all have to discard our physical chassis eventually. But he was impressed. He had observed you because you had had interaction with people of the Native background for a while, but he had watched you. And he said, I've noticed you're a good listener. People had approached him on writing his story, and he refused them. He wanted someone that was going to listen. Listen not just with the head, but with the heart and the spirit, because the culture is not just something about a costume. It's not someone beating a drum. And that's very difficult for people, I think, many times to assimilate. They don't realize that you've got to get to the essence, because these people have been around for thousands of years. They had developed cultures through those many, many centuries. And in a very short period of time, their culture seemingly was almost obliterated. And here, the elders of those carriers of the knowledge, there's very few of them left, as you mentioned in the book. And he chose you. He recognized you, and he said it'll be a family history, not just for his family and for his people, the Kiowa people, but it also would be for anyone outside of that circle. And to me, that is a phenomenal legacy to leave, you know, to leave behind. And he said, this is no coincidence, and this is important, and this is what we're going to do. And you bring out information regarding the ghost dance, early practices that were done by the people, the peyote religion, which I find that terminology interesting, doctoring, the aspect of Christianity and how it was forced upon these people and how it was assimilated as they merely changed what I call the costuming so that they could be able to survive. That's how I will phrase it. Mm-hmm. And this, you basically were given information of a cultural history that goes back 175 years plus. How long, Robert, did it take you in your conversations with Richie to be able to compile this information?
many years. Part of the complexity of creating the finished book lies in the way that Richie, like a lot of the elders that I know, relate their stories. And we tend to be, as Euro-Americans, we tend to be very linear. So, Donna, if you, you know, when you ask me a question, I give you a response that is as specific to that question as possible. And there's a one-to-one correlation in most cases between the question and the answer. But these traditional elders that I've known are very circular in their thinking and their reasoning and their way of relating. So I would go with a particular agenda. I had a rough outline of what I wanted to cover. And Richie would, like these other elders, he would respond in a way that didn't correlate to my question. And so I would get fragments of information on lots of different topics in any one given interview. So first of all, my background in sitting with him started during the days that I brought my groups there. So for many, many years, I was sitting with groups. They were asking questions. He was answering. I was writing things down. So I had all that background. Then I started for a number of years to do the actual interviews that were video recorded in some cases and audio recorded in most cases. And then after Richie passed, you know, I had really wanted to have this done while he was still alive, but unfortunately it was still years. It was, I think, another 7 years after he passed away until I finally figured out a way to piece all of this together. And what I literally had to do was to take the transcripts and write down notes in the margin of what the topic was and cut them into slips of paper and then paste them into these different folders of topics. And that's why the project took me so long to complete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gives the book a sense of a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I took the things that he said, but I rearranged them so that they would tell a cohesive story.
Now, the Kiowa are known to live in Oklahoma, but before that, they were very nomadic. They traveled. They were all across the American West. They came out of what we call Montana today, And then you say in your book around 1700, they made their way into the northern plains, and the plains at that time had the Crows, the Mandans, the Hadatas, and the Arikaras. Now, I've heard of the Crows, but I hadn't heard of the other three tribes. And they merged with those tribes, from what you said, and adopted the classic horse and buffalo culture of the Plains tribe. And then they got involved with the Lakotas and the Cheyennes, and that interaction caused them to move into the southern plains. Then they got in contact with the Comanches. Well, I think if anybody's watched any John Wayne movies, or any of the old movies of the Old West that were done by Hollywood, the Comanches were a warlike tribe.
Right.
But they ended up becoming peaceful with each other, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, they did. They started out as enemies and eventually became allies. And today, I would venture to say that there are a huge number of people who have both Comanche and Kiowa blood in them because they started really marrying into each other's tribes.
Mm-hmm. For peaceful purposes. Now, one of the things that I really was fascinated with, and I think so many people have these imaginary myths about Indians. These were people. These were human beings. And you said that the cultural attributes of the Kiowa, along with other plains tribes, was the hunting of buffalo or bison. They were nomadic. They used horses, and horses were considered a measure of wealth. And they had an emphasis on warfare and warrior societies. And I think there's been so many myths that have come about without an understanding of this. Talk about warfare, why that was so important to a Kiowa man.
The role of a man, the way that a man measured his value is in what he contributed to his community. And as warring people, it was through warfare that a man proved himself. So if you were a boy, you grew up seeing the actions of the men around you. And you grew up seeing them prove themselves through what they did in battle. So as a young man, for example, a way that you would impress a young lady is by what you had done in war. Now, it makes it sound to us like that's the only thing that's important to them. And what I would say is that you also have to look at the structure of warfare being very, very different than what we consider war. I mean, we have a European model of war that is, if you go to war against another country, you're basically out to annihilate them. And this is what European history has been like, and this is what the European nations brought with them when they eventually went to war with different Native American groups. But Plains Indians had a very different concept of war that I like to describe in a way as being more like war games. So you could prove yourself in battle. What would happen is you would accrue honors with a point system based on what people had observed you do. And you didn't come back and talk about what you had done. Somebody else would talk about what they saw you do. So different things that you did on the battlefield would accrue more honor to you. So, for example, if you rescued a fallen person of your tribe, that would accrue honor. Of course, killing another person would accrue honor, but more than that was something called counting coup. And that counting coup was how you got more honor than anything else. And that was when you dropped all your weapons, went out onto the field, and touched an enemy. I mean, you could literally just touch an enemy either with your hand or with what was called a coup stick and prove more bravery than anything else that you could do, because your enemy was armed and you were out there with either nothing or a stick. So that's why I say it is warfare as a way of proving worth, but it's not a model of war that is a correlate to what we think of as war.
Let's talk about the medicine men. Depending on the tribe, this was something often that took years of training. Someone just wasn't dubbed a medicine man or a medicine woman just because that's what somebody decided to do. They had to earn that right. I was intrigued with the fact that you bring out that those that were medicine men generally were specialists, and that was a surprise to me. I thought, wow, I thought that a medicine man was a medicine man, but you educated me on that. Tell us what qualified a person to be a medicine man, and what specialties did they have?
Sure, and I'm actually going to link this to what we were just talking about a moment ago. And we were talking about how what a man does earns him respect and honor, and we talked a little bit about how being a warrior would do that. Now, if we back up a little bit to life in growing up, one of the most important events in a young man's life, and in some cases in a young lady's life, was in going on something that non-Indians call a vision quest.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, Indian people refer to it as going fasting on the hill. But you would go up to a mountain or a hilltop or a special place of power, and you would purposely deprive yourself of food and water and shelter and all comforts for a specified amount of time. And if you were successful in getting this vision, you would also get with it the spiritual power that I talk about in the book. And that spiritual power would then be channeled usually in one of two ways. It could be channeled into your path as a warrior, so it would become a protective power that would keep you from harm when you were on the battlefield, or you would channel it specifically into a doctoring way. It would give you the power that would be the source of your healing ability. Now, individual medicine men would sometimes apprentice under another medicine man, or they would just get an intuitive sense of what that power that they got would be useful for. So if I use my Comanche grandfather as an example, the man that I mentioned earlier, Oliver Patapony, he went on his vision quest well into adulthood, not as a boy, but he went because he had terminal cancer and the doctors had given up on him. So in his vision quest, he went to the Wichita Mountains, where I just was yesterday in southwest Oklahoma, and he had a visitor who came to him who shot him with fire. So fire became the source of his own healing, and then somehow he intuited out of that experience after he was completely cured of his cancer that he never had again. But somehow out of that experience, he intuited this use of fire as a tool in doctoring other people. And he told me that sickness is like a fire, and you've got to fight fire with fire. So when he doctored a person who was sick, he would build a fire, let the fire burn down to glowing red-hot coals, pick a coal up in his fingers and put it in his mouth, and then blow the heat onto the person who was sick.
My goodness. Amazing story. There are a couple of other things that I also want to cover, and that is some of the ceremony. You've mentioned the vision quest, and I really appreciate the fact that you acknowledge a vision quest is a modern terminology, that this is mm-hmm. not what they culturally use. Let's talk about peyote. There has been so much stuff about this, and I don't know why in the Western culture people look at this as, gee, this is a shortcut for me to get to where I want to go.
Yeah.
In any culture that I've ever been made aware of where they have used something like peyote, whether it is a form of cactus, whatever it might be, they have a deep respect for it. This isn't something that you take 5 days a week, 6 days, 7 days a week, and you take it in volumes. No, there you have to honor it and respect it, and that is something that is indoctrinated in the culture of the people. But the post-Sundance period, you said, was peyotism, mm-hmm. and it is a cactus. Peyote is a cactus, and it grows mm-hmm. in Texas,
right?
And also, you know, Mexico has it. And it's the button of the cactus that is consumed. And this has been utilized in ceremony, for very specific reasons for thousands of years. Let's talk about this ceremony and why it is important, and why is it done?
Sure. Well, first, I want to talk with great reverence about this holy medicine, because it's there's no way for the average person to understand the respect that this is used as. It's used as a holy sacrament during the ceremony. So I think the great misunderstanding that the average person in America has is that when we think of peyote, maybe we think of mescaline, the one active ingredient in it, and we think of drug use as an indulgence, whereas for people who practice this religion, we consider this not to be a drug in the least, and it's far from an indulgence. It's something that is approached with the greatest reverence of anything that I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And my Comanche grandfather put it very, very simply, and he said, God put his holy healing power into this peyote for the use of Indians. That was the way that he described it. And there is a belief that there is a spirit that this holy medicine has, and that spirit is a direct connection between the person in the teepee and the creator.
Mm-hmm.
So the ceremony itself is an important part of it, because people don't take it on its own. They take it specifically in this all-night ceremony. And it's the exact opposite of an indulgent drug experience. It carries with it the same theme that I see of sacrifice in all of the major Native American religions. You know, there's always this idea that you don't get something for nothing. And they say that this peyote road, it's not an easy road, but it's a good road. So people go in on a Saturday night, usually, sometime after sunset, and sit up all night long. So basically 12 hours, you're sitting in one spot inside that teepee and praying and singing specific peyote songs that go along with this. And Quanah Parker, who was a famous Comanche chief, the way he described it was, he said, when Christians go to church, they talk to God. When we go in our teepee during this peyote ceremony, God talks to us. So they have, there is this belief that the spirit of this peyote is actually the connector, and people have compared it even to the notion of Jesus. So if Jesus becomes the personal intercessor between God and a person, in the same way, the sacrament becomes this intercessor between the creator and the person who is worshiping in the teepee.
Robert, we need to take a break here for a moment. Would you stay with me until about a quarter to the hour so we can discuss some of the
pleasure.
Other traditions? Wonderful.
Sure, my pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. You're listening to Robert Vetter. We're talking about the legacy of a man who has the name of Big Bow. This is about the spiritual life and teachings of a Kiowa family. We've got more information that we're going to be sharing with you. Don't go away. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a bit to find out more about this fascinating culture. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. My guest today is Robert Vetter. We're talking about the culture of the Kiowa Indians. He was given the opportunity to be able to be a part of a diversified Indian family. That's how I will describe it. And in the process of doing his research and being of a very, very curious mind, being adopted into these variables, he got to know about Big Bow, and his friend and family member by adoption, Richie, said he wanted to leave his legacy, and he left it with Robert. And we were in the process of talking about the peyote, and we had to take a break. And I asked Robert if he would stay with me, because there's some things that I think we need to be able to be aware of. The Hollywood image, Robert, to me is just so ridiculous so many times, and it really does the Indian culture a disservice. However, in your book, you give so much specific information about not just the peyote ceremony and how highly it was respected as a gift from the Great Spirit that was to enable people to be aware that there was something, number one, greater than they were, and number two, to be given insight. And there was an old medicine man, or actually he was considered a prophet among the Kiowas. And this is something in every Native American culture I've ever had the opportunity to either read about or talk with someone from that cultural environment. They have a deep respect, not only for their ancestors, but also for the fact that there's something greater than they are, that they really don't own anything, but they are custodians of whatever it is that comes into their life, and that's to be honored and respected, whether it's the earth, the water, the air. They're still human beings, and they have their failings, but it is something that they had a deep reverence for it, because if they didn't, their livelihoods are going to be affected, and they may not survive. But there was Apathau, or Apathau, and this prophet, his word, Apathau, meant they were scared of him, and I had to chuckle at that one. But you tell a story in your book about this ghost dance ceremony. Now, the ghost dance ceremony and other ceremonies, including the peyote ceremony, were outlawed by the U.S. government. Fear really took prevalence. Ignorance was at the base of the fear, always. But tell us about this ghost dance. What's the ghost dance, and why was it significant?
The ghost dance is significant because it took place at a time where the old ways were being thrown into question by the fact that Kiowas and other tribes were in this new situation where they were under the thumb of the United States government. And in cultures all over the world, a lot of times we find what are called revitalization movements that spontaneously spring up when rapid cultural change is taking place. I don't want to get too overly intellectual about this, but it's not unusual in that sense. So the idea of Christianity by then had been introduced. People were familiar with the general outline of the teachings of Jesus. And interestingly enough, Christianity became a way for people to, as odd as this may sound, and I made the point in the book, you might recall this, that it was through Christianity that they were able to maintain more of their religion than they would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So
very
the
true.
Ghost dance movement became a new religion that began with a Paiute prophet way out in Nevada. And this religion spread from Nevada all over the plains. Eventually, the Kiowas received it, and so they had these various different ghost dance songs and a ghost dance ceremony during which they would perform this dance, which was essentially a type of a round dance. And the dancers, who were more often the women, the men were more often the singers, but the dancers would fall down on the ground into trances, and during those trances they would communicate with their dead relatives, they would communicate with spirits, they would communicate with the Creator. And so the ghost dance religion actually became a way for them to hold on to some of their preceding beliefs, but also, most importantly, a sense of hope. The ghost dance gave them a sense of hope in the same way that the peyote road did the same thing for them. Now, a lot of people may be familiar with the end of the ghost dance movement and how it took place in South Dakota among the Lakota people, who developed a belief that their ghost dance shirts made them impervious to the bullets of the white man, and how they were wiped out in a massacre of Hotchkiss guns. And that ended the ghost dance religion on the northern plains, but most people are not aware that it actually continued on the southern plains considerably after that among the Kiowas.
You go into different aspects of healing that were related to you. And again, this is a book called Big Bow, The Spiritual Life and Teachings of a Kiowa Family. Robert Vetter is my guest. And Robert, I know we've just got a couple of minutes here, but there was a buffalo horn healing that Richie told you about, and his mother healed the grandmother of pain in the back, and these stories are absolutely fabulous. And I find a commonality in my observation among so many different cultural positionings of people, and how when a conquering group comes in, so many times they do not take the time to learn about what a people have been doing that's enabled them to survive thousands of years, assuming automatically that this is bad, this is evil, and they just don't get it. They don't have the openness of mind to be able to work and with people or get to know them. And I think your story is so extremely interesting. You go into the various aspects of healing. You go into their history. I think you're a very fortunate man. Now, Robert Vetter, with this, where can people go to find out about more of what you have done relative to the Kiowas and your research? Do you have a website?
I have a website that covers my general activities, which are the educational tours and also programs that I do for schools. So people can go to my website to contact me directly, and that website is www.indianjourneys.com. Again, that's indianjourneys.com. The book, though, is not available on my website. The book is available through Amazon.com. And again, the title of the book is Big Bow, The Spiritual Life and Teachings of a Kiowa Family.
And with the book, there is also a CD that comes along where you can listen to songs by Richard Tartza Sr.
Yes, and if I can just make one quick mention about that CD, I purposely left some of the descriptions, a lot of the rich descriptions that Richie makes about the songs. My goal for the book was for somebody reading it to feel like they were either me or one of the people with me who would sit in the living room with Richie. And one of the things that Richie always did was he always sang these songs that went along with his stories. So that's why the CD is a perfect accompaniment to the book.
It really is. And for those of you listening, if you, like me, are always open to learning new things about different people, different cultures, to expand away from myths that have been superimposed because of fear, ignorance, and perhaps desire on the part of some to have dominion over what they perceived was primitive without really understanding what it was all about. This book is a big step towards getting an insight into a cultural aspect that is a very rich part of North American history. And Robert Vetter, it's been such a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so much. I think you have fulfilled what Richie wanted you to fulfill, and that was to tell the story so that perhaps there will be those of younger generations that may want to even find out more about the stories that perhaps others have to say. Thank you, Robert Vetter, for being my guest today.
Thank you, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. More good things to share.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, I want to remind those of you in Western Washington, I'm going to be appearing along with a lot of other people at a wonderful event called the Emerald Spiral Expo, and that is going to be coming up, yes, in just a couple of days, and it's this Saturday. I will be appearing there. I'll be doing many sessions, and it's being held in the Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. Now, you can go to emeraldspiral.com and find out all of the details. It is free admission to the public, and it's a wonderful, wonderful event that allows you to interact with people of different skill sets, and you'll have a chance to communicate with them. You can chat with individuals if you're curious about massage work, if you're curious about crystals or things like this. You're going to find a tremendous array of very talented people that are more than happy to share with you what they know. And again, I'm going to be there. I'm going to have an abundance of books, but I also will be doing many consultations. So check out the emeraldspiral.com website. Get all of your details there. The hours are 9 to 5. I hope look forward to seeing you there. Donna Sebo here, telephone number 888-627-6008. I have to chuckle when I talk about how we have preconceived ideas about things. I'm just as guilty of that as you are. I really am, because I have had various experiences in my life. So just like you, I will have my mental filter on many times when I come in contact with certain experiences and environments. And through the years, I've learned how to sort of keep that in the background so that I really have a chance to see beyond what my assumptions might be. And that is a challenge, because we all make evaluations and come to quick judgments within split seconds, to be perfectly frank. Well, I came across a story by the woman of the name of Peggy, and I just had to smile to myself, because she had a son-in-law that was a very different type of a person. He just did things differently. And she had had a sort of preconceived idea about him. And she would feel uncomfortable around him, even though he would come over for dinner. And he just wasn't into the things that the rest of the family was into. Well, that made her feel sort of uncomfortable. Ever happened to you that someone is not fitting your expectations? Well, she said, we enjoyed doing things together. And in the course of the years, her daughter and her son-in-law had moved away from the environment that they lived in, moved to another state, and then eventually they came back because of a job opportunity her son-in-law had. So there had been a tradition in the family of having a family night. They'd get together, the television would be turned off, they'd play games, they were just involved in all kinds of stuff. And she said, this is a guy, her son-in-law, he was a nice enough guy, but he just didn't get into the things that the family got into. Games, that's okay. Well, she just sort of kept her mouth shut. And one time she made a comment to her daughter about, well, he just doesn't seem to enjoy this. And her daughter said, don't worry about it. He's happy. He does his own thing. It's not a problem, Mom. Don't worry about it. Well, as it turned out, this one evening, there was a lot of activity going on. And they just were sort of in a dilemma. And she had fixed a nice dinner, Peggy had, for the family, and everybody was sitting down. And she gets up, clearing the table, and her son-in-law, he comes along, and he's helping to do this. And he notices that she's going to throw out the bones of the chicken and this type of thing. And she said, he makes a comment to her. He said, what are you going to do with the leftover meat and this? And she said, oh, it's just going to go in the trash. Now, she'd done this for years. No big deal. He said, well, why are you going to waste that? Why don't you make soup with it? You've got a lot of meat on the carcasses, and why don't you do this? And she said, oh, I just never thought. Oh, that's so much work. I don't want to be bothered. He said, well, why don't you let me help you with this? He said, I can show you how to do it. So she still looks at him. And she said, okay. So unknown to Peggy, her son-in-law loves to cook. So he goes into the kitchen. He starts putting stuff together to make broth. He said, do you have this, this, this? And, of course, she did. She had some vegetables, and all of this went in the pot. And she's just watching him. She's fascinated with it. She's never had this experience before. So he asked her, do you have rosemary? Do you have any thyme? Do you have any sage? And she looked at him. And she thought to herself, you know, we're not playing games here, but this guy's doing something I've never done before. So Peggy just sort of gets into it. And you know what? The other family members, as this was all the broth for the soup was coming together and was cooking, if any of you have done anything like this, you know how the smell just sort of fills the house. It's wonderful. And some family members came and said, ooh, what have you got going on here? Well, Peggy was just surprised. The family really got excited. They said, wow, that really smells great. What are you going to do next? And so here her son-in-law, she discovered, had a knack for cooking. And in this experience, she found that there was something that really they had a common theme with. She loved to cook. He enjoyed cooking. Maybe he didn't watch football, and maybe he wasn't into doing certain games like the rest of the family was. But in the kitchen, this guy was an ace. So they found a common ground of communication that was absolutely marvelous. And I share that story with you because I think so many times we make assumptions and we don't give ourselves the opportunity to find an area of commonality between ourselves and another person. And sometimes I think that's the very thing that happens with cultures. We don't look for areas of communication. We don't want to drop boundaries that perhaps we have been taught to have. Now, it doesn't mean we become doormats. We need to be open to learning new things. And that's one of the joys, I think, that in doing this programming that I'm able to bring to you. I like to think that maybe you hear something or you find yourself thinking a little differently, or maybe, better yet, becoming curious about a reality of information and a shifting in thinking that can make a difference in your life and in the way that you think about other people. It really does make a difference. Sometimes that enables us to be able to break barriers that have been in place maybe for centuries. Have you ever noticed how many times in cultures people work so hard at maintaining hate? In my upcoming newsletter, there's going to be a video about a company that is in the Middle East where they employ Muslims, Palestinians, Christians, Buddhists. They have all kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds. And do you know this company is doing fabulously and everybody's working beautifully? They accept each other. There is a harmony and there's communication and there is no hate. It really makes a difference. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul, your mind, your spirit. It belongs to you. Allow it to grow and fly free. You don't need to be anybody else's doormat for their ignorance, their fears, and their superstition. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how to save the world just with $5 a day. Do you believe it's possible? Well, why don't you listen in? Tell your friends. Tomorrow we'll be discussing that. This is Donna Sebo. Have a magnificent day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.